Welcome to the latest edition of the Registers of Scotland podcast. I'm Roman Smith and I'll be today's podcast host. Today is International Women's Day and the theme for this year is Choose to Challenge. For those of you who don't know, International Women's Day is celebrated globally every year, celebrating the social, economic, cultural and political achievements of women. Today I'm joined by Jack Kelly, Media and Public Affairs Manager at ROS, and Deepa Manclair, one of the non-executive directors of the ROS board. Jack, welcome to the podcast. Tell me a bit about yourself and your role at ROS.
Thank you, Roman. As you said, my name is Jack Kelly. I've been working at ROS for almost 5 years. It doesn't seem that long, but it has been that long. I work in the communications team at Register of Scotland. And I'm also very proud to have been one of the co-founders of ROS Pride, which is our LGBT plus staff network.
Thanks, Jack. Deepa, it's great to have you on the podcast today. Tell me a bit about yourself.
Hi, Roman. I am so happy to be here. I have been a non-executive director with Registers since October 2015, and sadly my tenure is actually going to end in September this year. Alongside that, I'm also a non-executive director with the General Medical Council, the Public Health Agency and the Equality Commission. I run my own health tech company which specializes in AR and VR. I'm an artist and I have a very keen interest in equality, diversity and inclusion.
Thanks, Deepa. That sounds great. Jack, what does International Women's Day mean to you?
That's changed a lot over the past probably 5 to 10 years. I actually wasn't aware of International Women's Day, I think, till I was probably in my mid-20s, and I worked in the women's sector. So I saw International Women's Day very much through the prism of, I worked in Scottish Women's Aid, so it was through the lens of addressing gender-based violence and domestic abuse. And so I think I probably had quite a narrow view of it. Recently, I've started to really try and think about not just what it means to me, but what it means to everybody, to all women. I think that we can often think of women as this big homogenous group that all has the same needs and the same experiences. And actually, we're a really diverse group. We're 51% of the population. So of course, we're not all the same. There are different voices in there. People have different identities and multiple identities. And the way that I experience International Women's Day and the way that I experience my gender and the way that people react to my gender is going to be really different to the way that somebody responds to, a Chinese woman who's an immigrant here, or a Chinese woman who was even born here. And so, you know, and trans women are becoming a growing part of the LGBT community, and more visible, which I think is fantastic. So I really try to think of it just not in terms of what it means to me, but in what it means to all women. And I can't intuit that. That means listening to those other voices and learning from other people's experiences.
That's a really interesting view on things, Jack. Thank you for that. Deepa, what does International Women's Day mean to you?
So International Women's Day for me is a constant questioning of the gendered narrative that defines society. And it can manifest itself in terms of things that we don't know and data gaps. And I actually want to talk about a very specific example to illustrate IWD. So one of the most dangerous aspects of data gaps is that people are dying. And in this example, I'm sharing is from 2016, and it's the British Medical Journal report that young women with heart disease are twice as likely as men to die in hospital. And the reason is that the risk prediction models used were developed using patients who were two-thirds male. And aspirin, a commonly used prevention method, is actually harmful for the majority of women against heart disease. And the other thing that's happening is heart attacks are being missed when women experience them. Why? Well, women don't have the classic Hollywood heart attack, you know, with the chest and the left arm pains. And women actually may not have any chest pains at all, but are more likely to present with stomach pain, breathlessness, nausea, and fatigue. So that's what International Women's Day means to me. It's that opportunity to really spotlight on systemic failings in society.
That's a really interesting story there, Deepa, and a fantastic example of the different balance and inequality and why it's so important to talk about these things in International Women's Day.
I wondered also, just to kind of follow on from that point that Deepa just made, I was vaguely aware of that before because I think I saw a report on it a few years ago and I was horrified. But I wonder if also women are maybe socialised to challenge medical professions less. I have a friend who was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago, and her male consultant told her what treatment she was going to get. And when she asked him what the other options were, he seemed genuinely shocked that she'd asked if there were other options. He'd just presented her with, this is what we're going to do. And I don't know if maybe he wasn't used to patients generally doing that because we're taught to defer to medical professionals generally, or if there's something about women of a certain age challenging a consultant and that being quite unexpected and quite an unusual occurrence.
I think that's a really interesting reflection. And yeah, and I think there's a huge element of truth, isn't that? And that starts from day one. Be a good girl, do what you're told. Don't rock the boat.
I think that example and both those points there tie really nicely with the theme of Choose to Challenge for this International Women's Day. That's what this is all about, women challenging what society's norm of what we should believe and what we should be doing, which is a fantastic example from both of you there. We have a new equality, diversity and inclusion plan at ROS, which seeks to be ambitious. Jack, how do you think we make sure that it remains relevant and that the achievements aren't short-term gains but are part of a permanent culture change?
This is a discussion that I've been having with people within the LGBT community for quite a while, and particularly over the past 2 years since we founded ROS Pride. I'm very aware that in the LGBT community we've made a lot of progress in terms of legislative change and in terms of cultural and social attitudes as well. And one of the things that I'm very keen that we guard against is not taking those short-term gains for granted, not getting complacent, but continuing to always work to make sure that those rights are protected. We've seen in other nations, particularly Russia, is probably one of the most international kind of well-known examples, how LGBT rights that were enshrined in the law have been gradually eroded, and it's now a place that I would never go as an LGBT person. So I think we need to really guard against complacency. I think in terms of ROS, I think leadership's key to making that happen. I think we're in a great position at the moment where we have a real strong buy-in from senior managers, from the board, from line managers, and that really pulls the rest of the organisation along. I think it empowers people to feel that they can speak to the equalities agenda. I felt very supported when I noticed the lack of a ROS Pride group, and I knew that when I asked if I could set one up, I was going to be met with encouragement, not just permission, but encouragement to do it. And I think also I always feel like I've got to take an individual responsibility. So despite the fact that I've been involved in equalities and diversity for a really long time, I don't know even how long, probably most of my life really, or since my early teens at least, I always take equality and diversity training when it's offered to me, because I don't want to assume that I know everything now and that I don't have anything to learn. Things are always changing and we should always be making sure that our knowledge is at least up to date, but that our awareness is evolving and growing with us as people.
That's such a good point, Jack. You make a really good point that everything is constantly changing and evolving, and it's so important to keep learning and keep developing. Deepa, you're a member of the ROS board. How do you think we ensure these permanent changes?
Jack is absolutely right when she says that it has to be integral to leadership culture at ROS, because that drives so much. And I'm extremely proud of the fact that our board is probably one of the most diverse that I sit on in terms of the non-execs. So out of the six, 50% are female, 33% are from a minority ethnic background. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that this is still really unusual. I mean, Lord Davis published a report on gender balance of the FTSE 100 boards in 2011. And there has been some progress, but not enough progress, not fast enough progress. So in 2010, women made up 12.5% of the boards, and that's increased to 29% now. And that's still not good enough. And the numbers are worse when you look at sort of chair positions. They're much, much smaller. So, you know, it's important to have women from the diversity of intersectionality of backgrounds in leadership positions and to present and to be those role models. And I think often, you know, you get inspired to do something when you can see others like yourself doing it. And it's easier to imagine yourselves in those roles. And it's not really rocket science either. So Marion Wright Edelman sort of said, famous quote, you can't be what you can't see. So EDI is a priority for board members. The draft strategy is coming to board next week. And I know that there is going to be an incredibly full discussion on the ambition of the strategy, the vision, targets, resourcing, governance. I've been assigned as a lead non-exec to be an interface with the steering group that's proposed to be set up as well. And I'm so proud to have been offered that opportunity. But I also think that there's a bit of work within the organization so that everybody understands that EDI is everybody's responsibility. It's not just for people who might define an aspect of themselves as being protected by an equality characteristic. And that's if we want to move towards a permanent culture change. So we absolutely need to challenge discrimination when it happens. We need to understand our biases, whether they're conscious or unconscious. We need to have awarenesses around in and out group dynamics that can exist in the workplace. And education needs to be constant as well, because our awareness around equality is constantly changing. And to make sure that the EDI agenda stays inclusive, we need to be open to learning as people. So listening to Queer, their story last night, it was so insightful. And, you know, maybe society is becoming more accepting of certain equality characteristics, but at the moment it's openly hostile to trans people, for example. And it almost seems carte blanche, and it's okay to do that. And that's obviously wrong. So I think one of the key drivers this year within the organization is to capture as much diversity data as possible. And I would really encourage every employee to participate in this. So, and we then need to also look at diversity across all management levels and ask ourselves the question, are we being inclusive enough across the whole organization? And we need to talk to staff on a regular basis to review if the pace of progress is right. And we need to recognize also that our policies, system, and culture, how they can help in promoting the EDI agenda, but also be mindful to the fact that if we haven't gotten those right, they can actually promote inequality. So, as a non-exec in a leadership sort of position, I'm really open to open recruitment strategies with specific and measurable performance evaluation criteria, having transparent procedures for pay, for bonuses, promotions, and project allocations. And I think, you know, when we start to unpack and look at all of this, we start to really address some of those systemic barriers and issues.
Thanks, Deepa. You make some really good points there.
Just to pick up on what Deepa said there about how you don't have to be in one of the protected characteristic groups to get involved in the discussion, I think that's a really important point. I think that if you're not in one of those groups, it doesn't mean there's not a seat for you at the table. In fact, you're probably in a really powerful position to take a seat at the table and do some really great work as an ally. If you are a white, cisgendered, straight, middle-aged man, you've probably got quite a robust platform to make the case for pushing the diversity work. And I'm very keen that people don't see themselves as being separate from it in any way. I'm not all of the characteristics in the group. I think experience ageism at the moment. I don't experience discrimination on the basis of my age. I'm a cisgendered woman, so I don't experience transphobia. It doesn't mean I don't care about those things. It means that I want to use whatever voice I've got to try and make a contribution to try and address them as well. So there's absolutely room for everybody at the table in this discussion. And I think it's really great if people get involved and they're not in any of the groups. Oh, on the basis, of course, with a caveat that they come and listen as well as speak. Because I'm very clear that I don't speak for trans people. I speak in support of trans people when they speak.
That's a great point you make there, Jack. At Ross, we're really proud of the diversity of our board, as you mentioned, Deepa. We're really looking forward to taking our EDI plan forward and communicating what we're doing both internally and externally, like the event you mentioned last night, Deepa, of Queer Their Story, which was led by Jack. Deepa, you've had a really interesting career. The theme for this year's International Women's Day is Choose to Challenge. Can you give us an example of a time when you've had to do this?
That's a really interesting question. And in short, my whole life feels like a choose to challenge moment. So I've lived in Northern Ireland for 25 years, and it has been and continues to be incredibly challenging at times. I fell in love, which is the reason I moved here. And my first job was to write the first report into racism in Northern Ireland, and that was just after the ceasefires had been announced. So I guess from day one of being here, I've been challenging the status quo. It's normal for me to be the only non-white person around a board table and definitely the only female Indian. But you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So I've, over that time, carved out a career that works for me, and I have refused to be defined by how others may see me. And that's been the case since I was a child, and a complete pain to my parents, no doubt, as well. So I seem to have entered a mentoring stage of my life, and I'm really happy to share with others what little I've learned. So as I described in my introduction, I combine the non-exec roles, chief exec within health and immersive tech, and it all seems to work. And I think, you know, one of my sort of drivers for in terms of the EDI agenda is obviously on a personal level, that's obvious, but also on a professional level. And in terms of there's the ethical case, which is clear, that we can only truly have a normal society when everybody's differences are respected, however we choose to define those. But on a business level as well, you know, it's the business case is such a no-brainer. And living in a capitalist society, this is the thing that really baffles me. Diversity leads to innovation, and the business case is just so overwhelming. So we know, for example, that the profit margins at the most diverse companies are 14% higher, and that comes from a report that McKinsey did in 2012. And there's also a relationship between diversity and inclusion and innovation, where companies who have more diverse management teams actually have a 19% higher revenue due to increased innovation. Now that research comes from the Boston Consulting Group in 2018, where they worked with 1,700 companies across 8 countries. So for me, it's really simple. Diversity in thinking, experience, and background are obvious strategic competitive advantages to drive innovation. And if we can get this right as a company and other companies, then it's only then that you kind of build those meaningful services and products. And it means that companies are more likely to meet the diversity in terms of the needs of their customers as well, to generate ideas and to qualify concepts, to fill it, to kind of fill the innovation growth pipeline more efficiently. So I've kind of, I think, Roman, I'm sorry, I've probably gone away from answering that question really directly, but so sorry, I've probably steered away from that a bit.
That was great. Thank you so much, Deepa. Thank you for sharing your personal experiences. It's so interesting to hear how you've battled with challenge throughout your personal and professional career. Jack, you've mentioned your previous roles. How would you say you've challenged, changed in your experience?
That was a great answer, Deepa, and it's actually very close to the one that I'm going to give now. I think that anybody who's been involved in equalities and anybody who's from a minority community has probably had a similar experience to the both of us. I think that I challenge things every day, and I have done from a young age as a queer woman. Almost everything that I do in my life is a challenge to heteronormativity, to what's expected. I remember when I was really young, I think I was only 4 or 5, and I remember my mum and it must have been an auntie or something joking about what man I would marry when I got older. It wasn't who I would marry, it was what man I would marry when I got older. And so from a very young age, there's all these expectations on girls and boys as well, but there's an expectation that you're going to live your life in a particular way, and I never have really done it. I don't dress the way that I'm probably supposed to dress as a woman. I don't have my hair the way that I'm supposed to have as a woman. I look at women's magazines and shops, and there's nothing there for me. There's nothing there in the men's magazines either. But, you know, I don't really fit the mould of what it is to be a woman, even though I very much identify as a woman and as a feminist woman, and I live with my partner who's a woman. So, I mean, those might sound kind of insignificant in some ways, but actually it takes a lot of work to have the courage to do that. And I think also I agree with Deepa about I'm challenging people's expectations of what I can do as a disabled woman as well. The fact that I've got a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which means that I'm losing my eyesight quite rapidly, and I'm only in my early 40s. And of course, to an extent, that's going to limit what I can do. But I absolutely refuse to let those limitations be extended by other people's low expectations of what I can and cannot do. Every time I go out of the house, I feel like I'm confounding somebody's expectations. I've been told by people in the past that I was an inspiration to them because I went to a birthday party, because there was somehow this idea that if you're disabled and if you're blind, you just sit in the house on your own. And I'm always trying to push back against that low bar for disabled people and push back towards the heteronormativity that queer people had to grow up with, and try and find space within that for their own identities to flourish. So I think, I mean, that's maybe quite a general answer, but I think it's easy to underestimate just how much work that can be on a daily level, never mind across the course of a lifetime.
Thank you, Jack. That was really, really powerful to hear your own personal story. And that actually leads us on nicely to our next question of, do you think that we're doing enough, Jack, to make International Women's Day relevant to all women?
Generally, no. I think that this podcast is really refreshing, and it's a really great step in the right direction. I know that you were very keen to make this intersectional and embrace different community identities, and I think that's absolutely fantastic. And I think it's something that Roz is starting to really try to address and do well. In terms of International Women's Day generally, what I've seen of it over the past few years has been really white middle class women. I don't see what would be described as lower socioeconomic groups represented in that. And that's despite the fact that lots of those women are the very people who have put in a monumental effort over the past year to get us through the pandemic. They're key workers. And and that includes, we talk about healthcare, but that includes people who turn up to work at their supermarket shifts and get hassle from customers about shortages of things at the first stage of the lockdown. That was a big deal because of people panic buying, and they were putting up with a lot of nonsense and doing it while still smiling at customers. And those women aren't reflected in, I don't see Twitter threads about them. I don't see them in poster campaigns. I think if I phoned my mum up and wished her a happy International Women's Day on the 8th of March every year, she'd wonder what I was on about and think, I think she'd probably think I'd confused the date with Mother's Day, or something. So I don't think, it's not just about disabled women and women from Black and ethnic minority backgrounds. I think it doesn't reflect women who are from the background that I'm from, which is a working class background. I think it also really isn't doing enough at all to represent transgender women, and I think that's not going to happen overnight. I think there's, as Deepa alluded to earlier, there's still a lot of intolerance directed at transgender women, and we need to address that first.
I think you're right there, Jack. I think we need more work to be done to ensure that everyone feels that they are being celebrated in International Women's Day. Deepa, what's your thoughts on this? Do you think we're doing enough to make International Women's Day relevant to all women?
I absolutely and wholeheartedly agree with Jack. No, we're not. And the conversation absolutely needs to include the complete intersectionality of identity, the reality of identities that exist around us. So none of us fall into a single label, and our sense of identity can also change over time. So as we've become older, we may become carers or parents or whatever. So, we've got race, age, disability, neurodiversity, LGBTQ plus, socioeconomic status, and I mean a myriad of other quality characteristics and ways of describing our differences. And those have to be part of the conversation. I think an interesting starting point would be actually looking at education and schooling. In terms of civic citizenship, what it means to be a member of society, what it means in terms of people's access to rights, what your responsibilities are to your fellow human being. I don't think we do or talk about that enough. And Jack, just in terms of your answer to the previous question, around your day-to-day experiences, those are so profound as a human being. If you cannot, if you don't feel free or comfortable enough in a workplace, as a human being to talk about what you did at the weekend, who you did that with, who you love, those go are an intrinsic part of what it is to be human. And if any aspect of that is denied, then that's criminal. And that's as simple as this is on one level. And yet those are battles that, we're still fighting. And in Northern Ireland, they're incredibly apparent, that it's put down to consciousness, conscience or religious freedom. And that has to be challenged, I think. So we're not doing enough to make it relevant to all people because so many people are absent from the places where those conversations happen. Maybe the conversations are happening in the wrong place. Maybe they need to go out to where the diversity of voices are. We talk about society in terms of being meritocratic society, and that's nonsense. That clearly doesn't exist. And I am of the view that we need to start thinking seriously about implementing quotas now. And I know that that causes heated debates when you even mention the Q word. And there's some really interesting research, actually, which has shown that quotas are not an anathema to meritocracy, but what they actually do is increase competence levels by displacing mediocre men. And that's actually found based on research that took place in Sweden. And there's a kind of prevailing narrative in society where within the tech world, for example, there's a constant focus on why there's an underrepresentation of women, as if the issue, the problems are with women themselves. Whereas a more suitable question to me would be, you know, why do we have this unjustifiable overrepresentation of men? So, you know, it's about where power lies, who's asking the questions, and how is society being driven by that, is my very long answer to that question.
You make some really powerful points there and suggestions, Deepa. Thank you for that. International Women's Day has occurred for well over a century now, with the first gathering held in 1911. Deepa, leading on from what you've just said, do you think that we still need an International Women's Day?
Yes, I think we need International Women's Day every day, so IWDE. And it's really, I mean, that answer comes as no surprise, as we still have systemic inequalities in our society. And interestingly, so the first ever Women's Rights Convention, it was held in the States on the 19th of July in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York. So that's over 173 years ago. And it's interesting now, as we're on the precipice of, an economic recession, that some of the first jobs that are going across many companies are EDI posts. And that's exactly when you need these jobs the most. And that's often people who have lost jobs or will be losing jobs when furlough ends will be those who are economically vulnerable. That will be young people. It'll be people in terms of Black and minority ethnic. It'll be women who will all be impacted disproportionately. So, and globally today, you know, women face unequal access to education. So a quarter of young women across the world from the ages of 15 to 24 will not finish primary school. And two thirds of illiterate people in the world are women. And if you're not educated to the same level, then that affects every opportunity for the rest of your life. We still don't have employment equality. There's only six countries in the whole world where women have the same legal rights as men, which is staggering. We have job segregation still. Women are often found in the most poorly paid jobs with the most unsecure or insecure contracts. Women still bear primary responsibility for unpaid work, such as caring. And we still have a lack of legal protection in terms of domestic, sexual, and economic violence, and a lack of legal protections in terms of harassment in the workplace, at school, or in the public. You know, and if these places become unsafe and aren't protected, then women are then making decisions that can compromise and limit their goals, their children's opportunities. We live in a society where we have still a lack of body autonomy and access to birth control in this day. Poor medical care, lack of religious freedom and religious intolerance. I mean, the amount of abuse and hatred at Islamic women who choose to wear the hijab or the headscarf. It's just phenomenal. We have lack of political representation. And that's in all national parliaments. So at the beginning of 2019, only 24.3% of seats were filled by women. And when women, when we are represented in a balanced way, then, you know, issues like parental leave and pension rights are addressed. Racism is still a major issue where if you're a BAME woman, you're going to suffer systematically more. And when you bring in class to that, then that gets aggravated in an even more greater way. And then finally, we've got a society which still has a patriarchal mindset. So the beliefs and values attributed, you know, to men and women differ from the day that you are born. And we all pick up this messaging. You know, there's some really interesting tests that you can take, Harvard Unconscious Bias Test, gender, and it's fascinating, you know, in terms of displaying how that, how when you're bombarded with messaging on a daily basis and not being aware of how it can impact you. So there's so much work to do. Yeah, we've come a long way, but there's still so much work to do.
Thank you for those points, Deepa. Relating that to the current times we're going through is really relatable. And you make such a good point. It's not just us living here. It's for women all over the world. It's important to stand up for them and make sure their voices are also being heard. What's your thoughts on this, Jack? Do you think we still need an International Women's Day?
Yeah, 100%. And I actually really like Deepa's suggestion of an International Women's Day every day. That is something I would definitely get behind. It sounds fantastic. I agree with everything that Deepa's just said, actually. There was two points I wanted to just make briefly. I'm not going to cover all the points that Deepa made because I just agree with them, basically. She read my mind. The first point was that when we're talking about political representation, it's very poor. In Scotland, we've got a 50-50 campaign to try to work towards greater representation of women in Parliament and at local authority level. But what I noticed towards the end of last year and this year is so many of the MSPs, women MSPs, who I respect and think are really competent and really good at their roles, whether they're ministers or backbenchers, are standing down at this election. And they're doing it because of family commitments, family pressures, having to be away from their family and not having family-friendly hours. Or they're doing it for mental health reasons because of the amount of abuse they get on social media. And that abuse on social media isn't levelled to the same degree at male politicians. It just isn't. I'm also reminded of a week when, I don't know if it was a week or a day, but The Guardian published all of the articles by its male columnists, but under female-sounding names, and then monitored the amount of abusive comments, the number of abusive comments that those articles received with a woman's name attached to it, and the male columnists were really quite stunned at the response compared to what they were used to. I think social media is a really great thing. It's where I get a lot of my information, but it's really exposed women to a different level of abuse than was previously the case. So I'm not surprised that people don't want to engage with that. The other point I wanted to just pick up on was about how we're given these messages from the day that we're born about what men do and what women do and what girls are like and what boys are like. And I think we've got a big piece of work to do to try and unlearn those things. That's not just about gender either. I think as a white person, I try to read and I try to inform myself to unlearn about the racism that I grew up with and the messages that I got about people of colour compared with white people. I read a great book towards the end of last year, Why I'm No Longer Talking About Racism with White People, by Renée Idoloj. I read Akala's book Natives, which was brilliant. I met Akala also the year before, which was brilliant. I got my picture with him, so that was very exciting because he's a bit of a hero of mine. But I tried to educate myself to unlearn harmful racial stereotypes, and I think it's easy to assume as a woman that I don't have to do that with gender as well, but we all do. We've all got these things ingrained in us, and I think unconscious bias tests are a great way of, I don't know, examining yourself and letting yourself see about the areas where you might need to improve, or at least be aware that sometimes you'll have a almost an intellectual reflex, or a mental reflex is probably more accurate, that you're not entirely in control of, and it's important to just keep an eye on that and address it whenever it rears its head.
Both your points there are so interesting and links us back to our discussion about making permanent culture change. There's still so much for us to work on.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's not an overnight task. It's not easy. I think sometimes you have to confront some uncomfortable truths about your own attitudes. And I've had to do that. I'm not going to broadcast what they were, but I've certainly grown up, with attitudes that, well, now I wouldn't say I'm ashamed, but I am a bit horrified about things that I assumed or things that I took for granted. I certainly never, I think, really was aware of how much privilege I've got, despite being a queer and disabled woman. I've still got a huge amount of privilege. I've got a university degree, I've got a job, I have access to platforms like this to talk about my experiences, and now I'm grateful for it. I think I maybe took things like that for granted before. So we might have to address and acknowledge uncomfortable things about ourselves, but it's a valuable part of the experience, and you benefit from it as well as benefiting other people. So yeah, it's a long term. It's an ongoing goal. It's not. There's no end date on equality. We always have to keep working on it.
I absolutely have to agree with everything that Jack has said, that it's so important to have that self-awareness, and to, particularly when we go into new situations, because that's when I think all the kind of biases that have influenced us will manifest themselves, because you try and create safety zones, so you revert to a kind of belief system. So if you've got an awareness around that, you can check yourself, and it's absolutely something that you should never stop doing, for as long as you have the capacity to. And yet we all have, we've talked about today our experiences in terms of very personal and professional experiences that we have, but we also have power. And to recognize that, the fact that my parents were married and never divorced, the fact that I was supported through education was a huge privilege. The fact that I was enabled to go and study for a master's, I don't take any of that for granted. And even now, during COVID, that we can afford to, we have Wi-Fi, we have good digital connectivity, we aren't suffering from digital poverty. So my children have access to devices to be able to do their work. They're not having to share devices. That's not the case for a lot of people. So we constantly have to have that awareness and be bringing in all the different voices into the discussion, because our notions of what it is, for example, to be poor will change. Maybe, we're seeing that disparity between wealth and poverty widen, and it's just not right. Why are we not sort of fighting more as a society for economic equality? Because when you have economic power, it leverages so much else in society. Why do we blame people for their own poverty? and their own inequality. There's a real kind of pernicious overtone around this. So I think that it's good to ask challenging questions of those around you, of the institutions, and also of yourself.
Just on that note, I saw, this is just a thing that I saw on Twitter yesterday. I think it was shared by George Monbiot, and it said, it was on the point of meritocracy, that if hard work made you rich, every African woman would be a billionaire. We don't reward hard work, we reward privilege, and that really has to end if we're going to achieve equality.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and that's a fantastic quote.
You made such a good point, Jack, about there's no end date on equality. We all need to make an effort to continually educate ourselves on equality, diversity and inclusion, and also to look at not only ourselves but those around us who may not live with such privileges. Choosing to challenge is something we need to constantly do, not just today on International Women's Day, but every day. Thank you, Jack and Deepa. That was such an interesting discussion. With this year's International Women's Day theme of Choose to Challenge, it's been incredibly inspiring to hear from two women who choose to challenge in their work. I'd like to thank Deepa and Jack for joining us today, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to their stories too. Please subscribe to our podcast at anchor.fm/registers of Scotland. Thanks for listening.